When a choir member heard that I was a sociology professor, she said, "Will there be a test afterwards?" Well, I suggest that you administer the test to each other because I won't be here to grade it. So over coffee or over lunch, you can administer a test to each other and send me the grades afterwards. The election of Barack Obama to be President of the United States has stirred hope in many a heart. From the frustration, cynicism, and despair of the past decades, to the thought that, as he put it in that acceptance speech, the American people might once more put their hand on the arc of history and bend it towards the hope of a better day. It stirred my heart, and I guess it stirred yours as well. He almost echoed the biblical psalmist when he said that the influence and power, the strength of the American people was not in the military and was not in its great wealth, but rather, he said, in enduring American ideals of opportunity and liberty, freedom, of democracy, and also unyielding hope. And today I'm going to speak about hope. Why Christian people think about the future, what sorts of things should characterize our thinking about the future, and what difference it makes to our lives now. Our text is an extract taken from a letter of Paul to a Christian church. He was an early Christian leader. And the passage that I read from 1 Thessalonians 5, I'm going to be dealing with. So if you want to have that open, another way of checking on what I say, as you, if you have to think of it as professor, listen to the professor, a way of you checking is for you to look at the text and check that I'm getting it right. So if you don't have it open, that's fine. But if you do, it's a way that you can be checking on what I say. So he's writing to a church in Thessalonica, a small northern seaport in Greece. The church itself was mainly non-Jewish, although the Roman authorities who were over the colony imagined that this was just another Jewish cult. So it didn't really make any difference to the Romans. They thought of it as a Jewish cult. No one thanked these people for becoming Christians. In fact, they were mainly in a lot of trouble because they were Christians. They were being persecuted, they were attacked, they were under pressure for their beliefs. Paul praises what he found there in terms of their faith, their love, and their hope. And he urges them to persist in all three. And the little segment, the little extract that we're looking at this morning is his reminder about the nature of the hope. So it's the hope part that we're thinking about in this passage. Both of these letters of Paul focus on the future. Technically, it's referred to as eschatology. This focus on the future. Well, in a highly charged world like ours of global capitalism, geared to consuming more and more and more, especially in what is called the holiday season, short-term thinking dominates our minds all too often. And it dominates the minds of those who are our political and business leaders. Others in our world, of course, warn about the dangers of that short-term thinking and say that we should have much more long-term things in mind if we're to be responsible to our children and to our grandchildren. The consequences for them of our short-term carelessness with using non-renewable resources, for our wastefulness, our profligate wastefulness, for the terrible consequences of climate change, all these things, they would say, are consequences of our short-term thinking, and we need to think more in the long term. But you know what? Paul wants us to think about the future in a different way. He's not stuck with that short-term, long-term binary, those two options. He says there's another way for us to think about the future, And he talks about it in the passage that we have in front of us. He wants to think about God's future and us living it now. And in fact, the whole of that passage, the previous 10 or so verses in chapter 4, are also leading up to the section that we broke into at verse 1 of chapter 5. Why does he want to do this? Well, he says at the end of chapter 4, he wants to encourage those who are suffering today, those that are feeling the pressure, those that are feeling loss in particular, those who are losing members of the community, who die before what they had believed was going to happen, the return of Jesus. So, for various reasons, they need encouragement, and Paul uses this hope word to encourage them. And what he says in 4:13 is that all their experiences should be framed by hope. Whatever those experiences are, they should be framed by hope. And this word has a special meaning. Hope here is not optimism. Optimism is relatively shallow thinking about the future. It's just, well, I'm really hoping that things are going to get better. There's no basis to that. It's just optimism, something you cling to. This kind of hope that Paul's talking about connects what God has done with what God is going to do. And so it's a different kind of hope. It's hope that has a basis in the character and the promises of God. And so Paul says in 4:14, we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe. And then he goes on to talk about things in the future. So this kind of hope connects what God has done with what God is going to do. And for Paul, the death of Jesus on the cross is the very pivot of human history. And that is where he's making that connection between what God has done and what God is going to do. It's the defining moment, that cross, that resurrection. It is, as he calls it elsewhere, the very wisdom of God. When God's rescue and renewal project is revealed, Jesus dies. And what does he do? In that death, Jesus defeats evil. He demonstrates God's love for his whole creation and for all of us. And he provides the means of forgiveness and fresh starts on every level. Jesus rises from the dead and proves God's power. Yes, but for Paul, that's not enough. That doesn't end the story. He also guarantees the future. As he says elsewhere, the resurrection is the first fruit. Well, the first fruit of what? The first fruit of that complete work that God has in mind, the new age in Christ. Because Jesus was raised, the whole earth will also be raised to new life. And even now, Paul says, Jesus' resurrection breaks into the old world and shows us the beginning of the new. So then, what should we hope for? What sorts of things should characterize our hope? The title this morning is Burglary, Birth Pangs, and the Break of Day. And that's what Paul writes about in this text. It's right there. He piles on the metaphors. Paul often gets excited in his writing, and the more excited he gets, the more metaphors he uses. And here, they are all together, as in the title. So, have you ever been burgled? I guess some of you have. We had the worst kind one day, which is to come home and discover that they're still in the house. And I go upstairs and I find these two guys going through the drawers in our bedroom. And then, to make things worse, I'm standing in the doorway, which is their only way of escape, and they threaten me with a knife. Now, I didn't expect that. We didn't come home anticipating. They hadn't left their calling card to say, today's the day. It was unexpected. It was okay. It worked out in the end. Don't worry about that knife. It was okay. But it was unexpected. And were we prepared for it? No. And what about the birth pangs? You are expecting something to happen, but you don't necessarily know when it's going to be. This happened this year with us in June. we were hoping that Abby, the member of your congregation that was referred to, was going to give birth to what we were later to discover was our grandson, Finn. But we had to go away, and our tickets were booked. And we were hoping against hope that he would come before we left. Unfortunately, he didn't. So we had long phone calls from a very long way away with all the last details of what happened right up to the birth and then after the birth. Not quite predictable. It's not neat. You can't put it in your, well, you can put it in your calendar, but it doesn't make any difference what you put in your calendar, which day the baby arrives. So there again, it's kind of unpredictable, unexpected. We must be ready. And the problem in Thessalonica was that they were being told another story. Where was that story coming from? Do you remember in the passage we read? People are saying peace and safety. What's that? People kind of going to bed and thinking, yep, everything is okay. I can sleep easy again tonight. No, it wasn't just that. The Roman authorities had a word for it, which in Latin we have as the Pax Romana. This is what they had as their peace and safety. You pay the taxes, you send us the slaves, and we will make sure that you are protected from foreign enemies. And we may throw it in some bread and circuses as well. But that was the Pax Romana. And that was a distraction. It didn't help anyone be ready for any eventuality out there. And the people in the church were just as much affected by the Pax Romana as anyone else. Ironically, we see very similar things in our own day. In exchange for massive military and domestic security technology expansion based on tax dollars, we too are promised peace and safety. All too often, this is one of my research areas, it's smoke and mirrors. Whether we're talking airport security or video surveillance cameras downtown, only this year, a senior detective in London, England, and we use that example because it's the most heavily surveilled city in the whole world, 4.2 million cameras in Britain, this senior detective said, complained that less than 3% of all cases of street crime, street violence in London are affected in any way by the presence, the ubiquitous presence of those cameras. 3%? Well, we can talk afterwards about the smoke and mirrors aspect of it, but in fact, we're given promises that high technology politicians cannot keep. Paul says, don't be lulled into a false sense of security. Sudden change is coming. And he referred to some destruction. It's unclear from the text whether that destruction is what would be happening within 20 years of Paul writing it, or whether he's thinking of some further away purifying aspects of Jesus' return. Either way, alertness is called for. So, there's the burglary and the birth pangs. What about the break of day? So, a second aspect of the characteristics of hope has to do with the break of day. The hope that we have is the hope of something inaugural. When Obama eventually becomes president, he'll give an inaugural speech. And people will be looking forward to that. But in fact, they won't be looking forward just to the speech. They'll be looking forward to the cash value of that speech. They'll be looking for the new order that follows the speech. So the inaugural is a new order, not just the speeches that precede it. It marks the start of something new. So when Paul speaks of the day, as he does many times in that passage, when he speaks about the new day, he's referring to the return of Jesus to inaugurate that new order. The coming together, at last, of heaven and earth. It's even colorfully pictured in the last part of chapter 4, echoing Daniel's prophecy, a kind of descent of Jesus from the cloud to be met by believers and welcomed back, finally, to make that renewed earth home. The image there, again, is a Roman image that Paul's using. When the emperor returns from some successful mission to the town, the townspeople come out to greet him, welcome him, and take him back into the town. So Jesus will be greeted by believers who welcome him back to the now renewed earth, the new heavens and the new earth. Now, of course, this is a far cry from what many Christians have come to believe since medieval times, and especially more recently, about the return of Jesus and what follows after it. For several centuries, some have believed in heaven as some kind of a disembodied space in a distant location, and that the message of Christianity centers on going there when we die. And Jesus returns in this view to take us there. That view of the disembodied space comes from medieval times. In much more contemporary times, there are beliefs taken exactly from this text about the rapture. There's a contemporary film series called Left Behind, which, based on a literalistic reading of this text, people will somehow be snatched up to the sky out of homes, cars, and planes. You see bumper stickers in the United States that read, in the case of rapture, this car will be unmanned. And of course, there are others answering those bumper stickers that read things like, I had tickets for the rapture, but suddenly they disappeared. Or, the rapture was yesterday, and you're stuck here with me. So, one kind of bumper sticker answering the other bumper sticker. But in fact, a much more consistent view than what those bumper stickers will give you, a view that is rooted in the ancient texts and traditions of Jewish thought that then become, through the Hebrew Scriptures, part of Christian thought, and come into our newer testament, have to do with the day of the Lord being when God's creating purposes are finally brought to fulfillment, not to a wimpy, whimpering end. God's purpose in creating, sustaining, and renewing planet Earth will reach its final fulfillment. Jesus will appear, this is the more common word, Jesus will appear, reminding us that that heaven is God's dimension, not some remote real estate, to inaugurate the merging of those dimensions, heaven and earth, and to cut the ribbon of the new world. This is the renewal of all things of which Jesus speaks. Jesus used the word in Matthew 19. The Greek word there is palingenesis, the rebirthing. And he talks about being there. In fact, he talks about himself as the Son of Man. In other words, the Son of Adam, the Son of Earth. So the Son of Earth will rebirth everything. That's what Jesus is saying in Matthew 19. The new order in which the effects of human sin and rebellion will be halted forever. We'll be singing those great words of Isaac Watts, and Isaac Watts was right on this track of thinking of God's creation being restored and renewed. What do we sing in Joy to the World? He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. There you have it, the complete reversal, the inauguration of a new day. So we look forward to that new day. The moment is unexpected. It'll be a surprise, but it's coming. So what should we do now? How should we live? What difference should it make to our lives? I'm not telling you this, or Paul's not telling us this, just to entertain us. Paul has a purpose in mind. If it's no less than the coming together of heaven and earth for which we hope, then what do we do? How does the hope for the future affect our lives now? And Paul's reply isn't what you'd expect. He says, live the future today. If we're not to be taken in by the siren calls of contemporary culture with its peace and security propaganda, then neither are we to lapse into a passive waiting mode. We're not to put our lives on hold so much as to hold on to our lives. Get a grip and live tomorrow today. How can we be sure that we're doing the right thing? How do we know what it is to live this way? Well, Paul reminds his hearers of the basis of this hope. Jesus died not so that we'd be lined up to be condemned in a court, but to receive rescue, to turn our lives around so that we may together live with him. Again, from our text. And although the living with him will one day be fulfilled in its entirety, it starts as soon as we recognize that Jesus' death on the cross brings forgiveness, healing, and new hope. And anyone, including us here this morning, orchestra, choir, congregation, whomever, and anyone can come into that reality, even as we sit here this morning. Then Paul first proposes that we live as children of the day, sons of light, daughters of day. And he spells this out. What does it mean in practice? To be alert and self-controlled. Actually, the word is a word like sober in the Greek. While it's night all around, we are to be awake. Awake to the new dawn that is surely coming and living its reality right now. When the millennium came, Sue and Abby and two of our other children were living in Melbourne, Australia. And so we, in fact, got to celebrate the first day of the new millennium long before our friends in Canada. We were already there. We were already in the new millennium. And we were partying in the new millennium before you guys. Sometimes, in some families, just to make things easier around Christmas time, folks get together in November. And they have their Christmas celebration right there in November. They get a jump on everyone else. They are already in the new season of Christmas. And Paul is saying this is the kind of thing that he has in mind. Live the future that is coming now. Get on with it now. So, we can be already living the new day, even while others are not even preoccupied with preparation. Even when things seem so dark all around, we are children of the day. And Paul says, let's live the freedom and fullness of that day now. To be alert and self-controlled suggests being wide awake, so that we can see all that's going around and be aware of it, and also to live deeply. The drunk, Paul makes both literal and metaphorical use of that contrast, lives on the surface. The drunk is someone who is working on experiences, on temporary highs. The alert person can make judgments that are clear, not blurred, can be trusted. Christians, in a sense, should be the designated drivers of the new era of Jesus. So if Jesus is coming to make that promised shalom of heaven engaging fully with earth and to inaugurate the new world, then we're to be alert and awake to the possibilities. The ancient instructions to care for the earth that God has made and to make it fruitful, or to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God, or to truly love our neighbors as ourselves. These, Paul says, are for now. As children of the day, we are partners in God's project of renewal and restoration. And this means that, in fact, we might have a lot in common with some of our friends who think in terms of the long term rather than the short term. This week I heard Gwyn Dyer speak about climate wars, and it was a terrifying lecture about famines, dislocation, and warfare that are likely to ensue as climate change takes its terrible effect. He and others are right about the ruthless and radical changes that we need to make to put things right. But he offers no big picture within which to place that hope. And our text makes it clear that the larger frame is God's plan for a new earth, in which the pilot project was raising Jesus from the dead. And just as Jesus' decomposing body was not just revived or restored, but given a whole new kind of life, so the whole creation will be, as Paul says, liberated from its bondage to decay and given a fresh start, even better than the first. So, as Paul says to the Corinthian church, our labor is not in vain because of that. And so, turning lastly to what these children of the day have to do, Paul says we should encourage each other, build each other up, become a community of the actively hopeful, where the action is actually seen there. Like, for example, in the Fair Trade Coffee House out at the back here. These kinds of things show that we are children of the day, even while it's still night. Paul turns to yet another metaphor, a military metaphor, saying we should put on defensive armor to protect us from the forces of darkness. Children of the day should wear faith and love as a bulletproof vest. Well, he didn't say the bulletproof bit, but as a protection for vital organs in the chest, and hope of salvation as a helmet. It's tough being day children within the culture of the night. We need constantly to remind each other of what will be inaugurated. That big picture, God raising Jesus from the dead as a guarantee to the new earth that will be inaugurated when Jesus appears. And we need to work together in the certainty of what God is doing to live the future day now in our everyday lives and in our families, our neighborhoods, and our cities. Well, hope like this sure puts our present condition, whatever yours is, whatever mine is, in context, framing our fears and our failures within a larger future. What God has in mind for the appearing of Jesus for this day is an inaugural day worth the wait. So let us resolve, in the power of God's Spirit, to live now as day children